Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this month's City Talks podcast, where we'll be getting to the bottom of the gentrification debate. Before we get to that discussion, I thought it'd be a good idea to assemble my colleagues from the Centre for Cities to have a brief look at the upcoming open statement, to have a think about what we might expect and what it might mean. Joining me is our Chief Executive, Alexandra Jones, and our Principal Economist, Paul Swinney. So, Alex, first off, first showcase for the new Chancellor, Philip Hammond. Obviously, he spoke at the party conference, but this is his first big external event. How do you think he'll play it? What sort of tone, what kind of messages might we expect to hear?
I think he'll be looking to reassure the markets, businesses in the country, that they are doing all they can to make sure the economy stays strong. So I don't think there'll be big giveaways. The deficit's still large. There's concerns about the debt to GDP ratio. So I think they'll want to be reassuring on that. They'll want to show discipline on departmental spending. Having said that, they'll want to reassure people they're up for a slightly more interventionist approach. I think what we might see is it's probably borrowing for infrastructure, for roads, for rail, rather than cutting taxes as ways to stimulate the economy. So I think, again, reassuring people that this is a government that's not worried about intervening to make sure the country continues to trade. So I think overall it'll be a message of some continuity, but actually some shift in order to make sure people are clear Britain is open for business. Yeah.
And to what extent do we think or do you think it will be Hammond's autumn statement versus Theresa May's autumn statement?
That's a great question. I mean, we've seen recently Hammond came out, for example, on Brexit and was quite hard-headed about the challenges as well as the opportunities, and talked about, for example, excluding students from the immigration targets. And almost immediately Number 10 said, no, that's not our view at all. So I think it is a different relationship between Number 10 and Number 11, certainly from the Cameron Osborne era, where they were very close. They met all the time. And autumn statements before felt very much like George Osborne's statements with Cameron there. I think it will be different this time. I'd be amazed if Philip Hammond can be saying things that Theresa May hasn't signed off. Certainly the insider gossip is Number 10 is very, very keen to sign these things off. So I think it'll be as much May as Hammond, and she will see it as such.
It'll be an interesting sort of balancing act, won't it? I think to balance that, on the one hand, to show some distinctiveness and difference from the Cameron Osborne era, but nevertheless to have some continuity on some of the themes. And we see that in some of the areas that, you know, we're most closely looking at, things around housing, things around devolution, things around Northern Powers, Midlands Engine. Paul, talk a little bit about how you think that balance might play out.
Well, they've said very little so far, I think, in terms of specific details, particularly when you think about the Northern Powerhouse and it being very much about High Speed 3 linking Liverpool across to Hull, and then that wider element about transport. Haven't gone into a lot of detail around that. I think what we would like to see is perhaps a slight shift in emphasis away from what was the case under the previous government, with a big sort of emphasis on these big transport infrastructure projects, perhaps through more thinking about the importance of transport within cities. You know, how can you improve transport within Greater Manchester, within sort of Leeds and its surroundings, rather necessarily about those links between. I think it'll be interesting as well, you know, on housing, to see what exactly will be said around that. I think obviously Savage Javid had a lot to say about that at party conference. But this is something that we all recognise, that we need to build more houses. But I don't think politicians have really sort of come up with something to change that, to see sort of an expansion in house building. And, you know, this is Hammond's first attempt to have a bash at this himself, and it'll be interesting to see what he comes out with. But clearly, you know, there's going to be big things at play, such as Brexit, etc. And I think, you know, this piece in part will be about trying to sort of set out some of that, trying to counter some of the criticism that's likely to come from Labour in terms of not having a plan for Brexit. And the question, I think, is, you know, when it gets down to city or urban economic policies or subnational economic policies, how much airing will they get, and what will the balance be between those big elements around Brexit and actually those other things that we think are dead important in terms of trying to get the UK economy going?
Yeah, because it's an interesting one. If he can't really say very much about the Brexit negotiations, just given where we are, in a sense he might want to pad it out or fill it out by having lots to say about these sorts of areas, which typically
you know, they've tended to say less about, or at least, you know, chancellors tend to speak less a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And I think housing, I think, will feature. I mean, Sajid Javid has been very clear. It's his top priority. They've moved from it being just about ownership to being about rent as well. And I think certainly the planning system will come under renewed scrutiny around this. But I think they will be looking to do things like that, because what's interesting about that is it's a big national conversation. Yeah. It's one that reassures people that we're building the homes the economy needs, that people need. It's about a country that works for all. There's some stimulus there because you're actually building things. That's getting jobs going. And it's not saying anything about Brexit. So it ticks lots of boxes. So yeah, that's one of the areas, that's an infrastructure that I would definitely expect to see something on. The question will be, given fiscal restraint and wanting to be careful about how much you spend, how much he's willing to borrow to fund some of this stuff. And I think that's not clear yet.
Yeah, not quite. Yeah, actually, that is the unknown, isn't it, in terms of whether he will be specific around making a commitment to borrow X in order to do Y, as opposed to making vague statements around, you know, we're willing to borrow if necessary, or if the opportunities arise. I think we can be fairly confident that Andy Street will get some mention in the speech, given you know, the possibility that he would be he may well be the mayor of West Midlands in less than 6 months' time. But in terms of devolution, can we expect anything more? Can we expect more detail on the devolution deals that are currently on the stocks? Could we see more announcements around places like Solent and confirmation of West of England and South? I mean, what do we think?
I mean, it's been traditional that the autumn statement and the budget have been great times to bring these things out with a flourish, either on the day or just before. And I think if they can, they will, not least because there is a deadline. If you're going to have a May 2017 election, you need to get these orders through Parliament pretty much before the autumn statement, actually. The Electoral Commission wants about 6 months. So I think if they can, they absolutely will. And West of England and Solent are two that are certainly up for grabs. There's discussions in and around Leeds, but I'm not sure that it would be resolved in time for the autumn statement, which I think is a shame. I think it's a really important area for some kind of deal. So I think maybe some high-profile stuff. Northern Powerhouse, Midlands Engine, certainly with Andy Street, you might see something there. I think perhaps along the lines of the infrastructure and demonstrating it's not all about London, I think you might well see something there. In terms of devolution, though, I'm not sure we'll see that much progress necessarily on devolution of powers. So signing off deals, yes, probably. Infrastructure investment in the North or the Midlands, yes, I can see that. More deals or an extension of the devolution agenda, I'm not sure that's as high on their priority list right now, given Brexit and everything else, so I'd be more surprised by that.
I suppose, go on.
I was going to say, it'd be interesting to see, given how much airtime Andy Street has been, or reference to Andy Street that have been made, I think, in recent months, whether actually Birmingham will get anything more than that sort of the test case. But again, you know, it might be a case of let's wait and see if a Tory mayor gets in first, and then we give the powers, which perhaps is a little bit different to how George Osborne would run this sort of thing, particularly with the deals he struck with Manchester. So again, I think your party conference was a time to start to understand some of the thinking of Theresa May and Philip Hammond, and hopefully the Autumn Statement sets out some of this a little bit more.
I think that's true on fiscal devolution. Yeah. There's rumours about the West Midlands and fiscal devolution. Mm. That would be quite a rabbit to pull out of the hat. Would support Andy Street. So some of it, I think you're right, will depend on confidence.
Yeah.
He can pull off that 4.5% swing.
And I suppose the other area, which it'll be interesting to see how far they've got to, not least, you know, we've been a party to lots of different conversations with lots of different bits of government over the last few months around the industrial strategy, what it means, how it's going to be organised, who's going to be responsible for it. We expect some announcements or something to be said in and around the Altman statement. And I suppose, you know, the question there is the significance of place, not least because undoubtedly Nissan and the agreements that have been given, or the assurances that have been given to Nissan, won't be far away when we get turned to those questions and those issues.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's going to be pretty high profile, actually. And the place element, I think, will be a big part of the country that works for all. And you know, if it is May's statement, which I think it will be, then I think being able to talk about some of the challenges the country has, about the North not performing as well as it could, about the second cities not performing as well as they should, this may well be seen with the industrial strategy as a route to doing this as a chance to change some of that, to look at some of that rebalancing. Yeah. So I think place will feature. The question is how much they will be willing to reveal, particularly post-Nissan.
Yeah, and that's the thing about, obviously, the Nissan intervention is that that's very much a sort of an industry-specific intervention rather than a place-based, although clearly it has a huge sort of spatial implication in terms of its factory within Sunderland. What does that mean in terms of the rest of industrial strategy? Is that then going to be a pull over towards doing specific deals with industries off the back of Brexit? Or is it actually going to be about how do you encourage growth within certain places? You know, and Greg Clark says a wonderful line, which is, you know, growth doesn't happen in the abstract, it happens in specific places. And it seems that he's very much pushing from that angle in terms of place-based industrial strategy. How do you encourage job creation, growth of the economy within places themselves? Mm. But, you know, some of these conversations, because of what's happened with Nissan, may well start to be skewed more towards an industry focus. And it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out in the coming months.
So if we're thinking about the big themes or ideas, going back to the Auto Statement and Hammond, I mean, Alex, you mentioned sort of confidence and reassurance to the markets and to industry that, you know, the government's on top of it. There's a theme around clarity of objective and purpose that, you know, the government undoubtedly will want to convey and communicate. Even if they can't do that on Brexit, they can probably do that on a bunch of other things. I think that there's a big theme, obviously, that May has talked about, which is inclusivity, you know, everywhere and every place. Are there other big themes that you think that will be framing, organising for, you know, not only for the Autumn Statement, but actually, I think, for for the period then running through into 2017?
I mean, I think being open to the world, being open for business, up for international trade, it's a clear theme that's been emerging from the ministers responsible for Brexit. Mm. And I think I would expect some measures that support that, even if they are just words at the moment, because you can't reveal the detail of strategy. So I expect to see more and more trying to establish at least relationships with other countries, look at how you can improve exporting. I'd expect to see some things, and that just to be a theme of the rhetoric, if not the policy. Mm. I also think growth, and kind of getting growth moving and demonstrating that the referendum result has not led to some of the big economic shocks that were predicted, will also be a big theme, both saying, well, it wasn't as bad as many predicted, but also setting out how particular places, particular industries will grow in the future. And that pulls together some of the things you were talking about, the confidence, the reassurance, the clarity. But I think that's likely to be one of the big themes. George Osborne always had a phrase he had through the budget, you know, March the Majors. There was always something that pulled it together. What will be really interesting is to see what this is for Hammond, if he goes for that rhetorical flourish. And if he does, I'd expect it to be something about growth for all. Or international growth for all, or exporting to the world. But those are the kind of themes I think they will want to get out again and again. Careful with money, but open for business.
It's going to be dominated from an international economic policy point of view from the implications of Brexit, be that investment into the UK or trading with the rest of the world. And then from a domestic point of view, expect the overarching theme to be place-based industrial strategy. And I think the question is whether we actually get more detail under those themes, because they've said it a lot already, and that's linked in with, you know, with a country that works for all. But what is the detail underneath that? And will the Autumn Statement actually reveal that? And I don't think that's particularly clear at the moment.
Yeah, very good point. A balancing act, as always. We'll be, I'm sure, post the Autumn Statement, we'll have plenty more to say on what the Chancellor ultimately talks about and all the documents that come with it. But for now, thanks for listening.
And now to our panel discussion on gentrification and whether it's a good or bad thing. Joining me, I had Anna Minton, reader in architecture at the University of East London and author of the book Ground Control, Toby Lloyd, head of policy at the homelessness charity Shelter, and Ed Clark, analyst at the Centre for Cities. I started by asking Anna to give her take on what gentrification is and what it isn't.
Well, I think that's the problem. It's such a slippery starting point. Gentrification has become one of these words, a bit like affordable housing, which don't really have a meaning. They sound sort of vaguely positive to many people, but actually when you start to unpack what the term means, it means a whole host of things. So I think if we're going to have a clear-eyed discussion, we need to really decide what it is we're talking about when we discuss gentrification. So there's a starting point for me, and there's another sort of where we are today in parts of London. And a starting point has to be Ruth Glass, the sociologist who first coined the term gentrification in 1964, when she was describing what was happening in parts of Islington when middle-class families were moving in and doing up workers' cottages, and in the process improving the area, but also sometimes displacing local residents and communities. So it was a contentious process from the off, but also it appeared to be having some positive benefits from the off. But in the mid-60s, the circuits of capital which were driving this process were flowing at a far, far slower speed. So it's not really possible to compare those sorts of processes that she was talking about in parts of London with the huge global influx of capital into London today, which is resulting in, let's take another example, for the Haygate estate, which was an estate of 3,000 homes of people on predominantly low incomes in Elephant and Castle, which has been demolished to make way for Elephant Park, which is 2,500 luxury apartments, of which only 79 are social housing, completely changing the social mix, demographic and nature of the area. Now, is that gentrification as well? Can those really be compared? I think those are some of the issues that we're talking about. I'd argue the latter isn't gentrification. At the very least, it's something I'd call state-led gentrification. Yes. But campaigners would go further and say it's social cleansing or domicide. So I think, you know, there's such a span of issues before us. And it's a very problematic term. It's so problematic, I almost wonder that we should stop using it.
Yeah. And already, I mean, Toby can come in a second, already there's an issue around who's driving that process and whether it's more or less organised either by the state or by someone else, as opposed to, you know, different changes as a result of individual decisions, even if cumulatively we see them, you know, in an aggregate. Toby, give us your perspective on what do we mean by gentrification?
Well, I think as Anna's highlighted, it means a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I think part of the issue here is that there's a difference between the individual level, the kind of neighbourhood level and the city-wide level.
Yeah.
Cities obviously change at every single level. As Anna said, the pace of change does matter. Changes which might take generations might be entirely, you know, normal, healthy and good and the way that cities have always changed. But those very same changes, if they happen very, very rapidly, can feel like major dislocations to people and can have serious social and economic consequences. So the pace of change matters as much as the nature of the change. So I think from our perspective, the most important thing is simply that cities are able to provide for the people that live in them. And that means that change will happen on a local, on a neighbourhood level, and we can't assume that that's always bad. That's, you know, it can be good, it can be bad, it depends. But at a city-wide level, it's vital that change processes do still allow for enough diversity of income and enough diversity of different types of people to live and thrive in those places.
Ed, additional thought, I mean, picking up on Toby's points around the differences between neighbourhood or small area change, which has always been historically part of, you know, cities and urban areas through the generations, through the centuries, but then not forgetting that we also need to think about that city-wide perspective as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the sort of crucial part, really. I think the other bit that I'd add maybe is looking at who's doing it and who we blame within that, and those kind of tensions that come with that. So I think, you know, taking that city-wide perspective, for cities to be successful, we need to make sure that they can welcome newcomers and make the most of new workers, new people in their areas. The question is, how do you manage that? So we get back to some of those issues. You know, do we have to, therefore, look at neighbourhoods in the same way, or can we see them evolving and using different parts of cities in different ways? And I think that management is where you get the tensions. I think that's sometimes projected onto the people who come in, because that seems to be the easiest target to look at and the most obvious, but actually it can be a bit sort of wider than that.
It's undeniable that when any change happens, there are some people who like it and some people who don't like it, some people who benefit from it, some people who lose out from it. And you know, understandably, those who don't like it or lose out have every right to complain, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily objectively bad. But likewise, just because some changes happen and benefited other people, that doesn't mean it's objectively good either. We do need to look at these things in the round.
Yeah.
And you know, we have to recognise that there will be competing interests. And people have every right to stick up for their interests, but they also have to recognise that so do other people. There will always be change and there will always be tensions. As Ed says, it's how we manage those tensions and how we make sure that the losers don't lose out too badly from change and that the winners don't gain disproportionately at the expense of other people.
Yeah. And Anna, you talked about, you know, the history, Ruth Glass, you know, Islington, modern London, but it's not just a London issue or problem, is it?
No, it's certainly not just a London problem. I mean, San Francisco, Vancouver, those are other cities which have been much in the headlines recently for also being subject to massive pressures for similar reasons in the Bay Area, because of the huge wealth generated by Silicon Valley and the knock-on impact that's had on the traditional community of San Francisco. So it's happening all over the world. New York, of course, very much similar trends to London, which it was showing much earlier than London. And it's happening all around the UK. It's not just London. It's Manchester, it's Bristol, cities all over Britain. I mean, I think what Toby said about the city being a site for competing and conflicting interests is exactly right. The city is a contested space, and so it should be. And in a democratic culture, we have to allow those contested interests to find a voice. But I think, for me at any rate, the context of this discussion and why gentrification seems to have had so much interest recently, you know, it's quite a hot topic,
is
that London seems, in the last few years, since the financial crisis in particular, to have really ramped up these processes. And I would say, actually, from my viewpoint, they are problematic processes because they're causing this affordable housing crisis, which is meaning that, you know, so many people can't afford to live in the city, even people on average to relatively high incomes. And, you know, it's becoming, along with the housing crisis, a key political issue, which is starting to challenge those positive connotations that the term has often had. Mm. Because historically, it has been connected with improving a place.
Yeah,
and that's entirely right. Britain as a whole faces a severe housing shortage, and that is absolutely amplified by kind of flows of hot money driving up property prices and squeezing people out, and that is, you know, undeniably a bad thing when that happens.
Yeah.
Huge numbers of people that Shelter deals with every day are facing the very, very sharp end consequences of those processes. I suppose that what I would argue is that in that sense, gentrification is merely a term for change that I don't like.
Yeah.
In that sense, it's not a particularly helpful term.
Yeah.
What is undeniable is that there is a severe housing crisis, and that the way the market is playing out through the housing system is having massively detrimental effects on huge numbers of people.
Yeah.
Now, you can call that gentrification if you like. Actually, in a lot of places, it probably isn't. It is literally just people being priced out. It doesn't necessarily even in carry with it the social implications of the term gentrification. It's just a straight market effect.
Yeah.
In other places, it's not a market effect at all. It's a deliberate consequence of policy choice.
Mm.
You know, Anna mentioned some of the estate regeneration programs, which have seen social housing replaced with extremely expensive housing. Now, that's the deliberate consequence of government policy over the years.
My own sort of, I guess, personal definition, which is maybe is becoming more clear. I don't really go in for personal definitions. It's better to have rigorous, academic, objective, evidence-based definitions. But my own personal definition is around housing and a sort of aesthetic that seems to go with gentrification and leisure, entertainment, sort of local businesses which sort of seem to spring up around gentrified areas. And to me, I think that in the parts of the city where these processes of housing change, shall we call them, are, you know, the most evident, all those aspects of gentrification which seem to, you know, be so easily identifiable, like, you know, the hipster cafes or the cereal cafes or sort of artisan bread for a fiver. I'm not saying they're unpleasant places to go and sit and have a coffee. they're nice, but no, they go together.
But it is part of that, you know, the bigger trend that we've observed as others, in a sense, you know, the renaissance, the revival, whatever word you wish to use, of urban living. You know, and if you think back 60s and 70s, if you got on, you got out. You know, richer people, you know, typically went and lived in, you know, in the suburbs, or they lived out in the countryside. And there's still a degree of that, but actually what you've seen, certainly through the, you know, the 90s and the 2000s, is a return to people, particularly younger professionals, but not exclusively, you know, wanting to be in and around urban areas, not only in a London, but it's the same story in a Bristol, you know, in a Manchester. And there is a lifestyle, you know, a cultural and social element to those sorts of preferences. You know, they want to be close to work, but they want the amenities on offer, which, you know, sometimes then jars with that as well. So, you know, I wonder whether, you know, that and that's partly to do with the change of our economy and, you know, how we derive value now in an economy. But, you know, I think there's an interesting bigger issue about, well, cities becoming more attractive again. And well, that, you know, that then...
Put the nail on the head. You know, it's economic change. You know, the industrial city with its factories and docks and warehouses and certain grime increasingly wasn't a very attractive place for people to be, who'd rather go out to suburbs and, you know, have big gardens and commute into work. And the post-industrial city, which has converted these places into trendy warehouses and loft living, etc., has sold itself on becoming a very attractive place for the new workers of the new economy.
I think you're not exactly right, and that's sort of the changing role of cities is never clearer than that, really. And I think, you know, if you look at the data the last 10 years, our data showed that it was about 37% city centre residents have increased by that much. So, you know, that is driven by younger people when you look at it, quite often students as well, which I think is quite an interesting kind of subsect of this, especially outside of London. In places like Manchester, the gentrification argument has got a slightly different sort of take there, where it's actually much more to do with how those kind of sort of semi-seasonal population changes in somewhere like Sheffield, where, you know, city centre living is driven by students. You know, what that means and what that means for services is quite different, and you bring a whole different type of sort of city centre, and what the role that plays within the city changes. And I think that maybe is a different take on the sort of gentrification element, and that brings a lot of positive changes, you know, a lot of activity, a lot of commercial activity as well.
Yeah. Isn't the difference between that kind of to put it crudely, kind of good gentrification, making places nicer and more attractive, and bad gentrification, which is squeezing out of poorer people, to put it crudely, isn't the critical difference there just the property market effect? You know, no one would say that it's a fundamentally bad thing that people are selling artisanal bread in an area and that should be banned by government policy. But it becomes a signifier that something is happening in the property market which will have damaging consequences for people.
It's also recognition that all improvements ultimately get capitalised into rent. That's one of the observations. You know, in a sense, if you improve the lot of an area in some shape or form, that gets captured by rent. If you're an owner of a place, or you're in the social housing sector, you can either be shielded to a degree or you can benefit massively. But if you're in the private rented sector, if your income doesn't correspondingly improve at the same rate as the rents in which, you know, you're being asked to pay, you get, you know, places and people and firms get displaced.
Absolutely. So if you've experienced these effects first in the private rented sector, but over the medium term in the owner-occupied sector as well, because first-time buyers become squeezed out and are unable to buy it. Now, that effect takes time to play out.
Yeah.
People tend to live in homes a lot longer in the owner-occupied sector, but it's the same effect happens. You still get the displacement of poorer households.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in the urban context in Britain, where most of our cities still have quite a large social housing stock, although it is diminishing, what that effect drives is polarisation.
Right.
And I'd say that's almost a bigger challenge than gentrification per se, because that's where you end up with kind of hollowing out of the social demographic in cities, and you end up with a very rich, affluent owning class, a residualized class in social housing who are shielded from those changes, but increasingly find that the services and the amenities in that area are beyond their income reach, so they're angry and disenfranchised or excluded without being displaced, and then a middle earning population that is increasingly finding itself physically displaced from the area. That's, and that feels to me a particularly dangerous position to get to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's one in which no one is really benefiting from, and everyone it breeds suspicion and distrust in our urban environment.
No, that's sorry.
Go on. I was just going to say, I think that's definitely what sort of, we've noticed as well, and I think that's definitely true. I think this, if the follow-on on that is kind of why, and what can we do about it? Because some of this is what it's quite often framed as inevitable urban change, you know, that if a city's successful, then people will move in, and by definition, scarcity of space means people have to move out. But I do think there's a city management element to that where, you know, if we continue to artificially restrict ourselves from building more, be that through things like the Green Belt or be that thing like things through, you know, designating certain areas towards just for housing rather than for business growth, for instance, or, you know, any element of sort of these planning constraints means that we are actually making these kind of things worse. And, you know, there are elements within our grasp that we could do better with.
It's definitely a question for management. I would disagree that planning inherently makes these problems worse. Actually, planning is the only thing that stands between us and these effects. As Andrew said, land markets inherently capitalise all of the economic growth into the hands of a dwindling minority that own everything, left to their own devices.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as a free market in land.
Yeah.
It will always be a regulated and politically contested market. And that's where the question then is, how do you set those rules and in whose interest?
Yeah, I also want to pick up on something that Toby just said, and just explore a little bit about why we should be concerned about, you know, the change that you were at, you know, the polarisation, you know, the differences. Not so much from an individual perspective, but, you know, you were hinting at societal concerns about the way that societies and or cities function. So we'll definitely come back to that in a second, but Anna, you try
well,
to...
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, I'd like to pick up on that point as well. And I think all our cities are now a patchwork of segregated areas of wealth and poverty side by side, and that's creating a very difficult, mistrustful and fearful climate, which is feeding through into political life and political culture in all sorts of ways. And actually housing is one of the battlegrounds where that's felt, and, you know, we've seen many others in our political culture, you know, not least the recent EU debate.
But have cities always been like that?
Well,
haven't
they
always been a patchwork,
yes,
mix of
they have, but the point is they are much more so.
Okay.
And at the same time, we're all able to see much more clearly where these differences lie.
Right.
And I just want to bring that point about segregation back to your point about rent, because I think these points are actually linked. And they're also linked to, I don't know if you're familiar with Neil Smith, who's the academic who's probably the sort of father of gentrification studies in New York. And his analysis of gentrification is that it's all about what he calls the rent gap.
Mm.
And when the rent gap is sufficiently high between actual values and potential values, that's when you see a huge flood of capital into an area, which will quickly transform it. And I think that's very much the basis for what we've been seeing in London recently. And part of that is that there are still parts of London which have been seen as very undervalued, you know, often locations which are, you know, quite central. And there where money piles in, assisted by a range of local government policies and the opening up of regeneration opportunities, and then these areas get completely changed and their social demographic gets completely changed. So Toby's point about segregation and your point about rent are absolutely critical to the discussion.
Very good. So let's tell me why at the sort of social or societal, more than individual level, polarisation, segregation, distinctiveness, what's the social argument for why we care about that sort of stuff, Toby?
Similarly, I think as Anna touched on, it breeds mistrust and lack of understanding across different sections of society when they're increasingly in very, very different
worlds. It completely undermines civic life.
Right.
But also it increases when that gap becomes bigger and bigger, it makes it even harder for people to ever imagine that they could cross it. So it absolutely reduces incentives on people to work hard and do their best, because that gap is absolutely unbridgeable. And, you know, you look at people in a lot of inner city areas in London now, particularly London, they know that no matter how hard they work, they will never get on that housing ladder.
Yeah.
And that's not good for their life chances, it's not good for their economic prospects, it's very bad for overall economic efficiency.
Yeah.
What you end up with is cities that then can't even staff their basic services and ultimately do strangle themselves, and their own economic success gets choked off by the inability to house people at different income points, which you need to keep the city itself going.
Yeah.
When a city can't afford to maintain any teachers or nurses or any of the people that run the services, it will cease to function so effectively, and it will see, you know, you could say in a global level, fine, that's just the system balancing itself out. I happen to care about the thriving of our cities now, and I'm not prepared to wait for it all to come good over the next 1,000 years.
Okay, and are you... It undermines the very nature of civic life, I think is what you said when Toby started. Just unpack that a little bit, tell us what you mean.
Well, I think when you have more and more parts of the city which are not open and inclusive to everyone, it becomes a much more problematic place to navigate for all its inhabitants. I mean, I've written quite a lot about the privatisation of public space. A lot of so-called public space in London isn't public anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There is restrictions on access, on behaviour, you know, sort of innocent things, perhaps like skateboarding or taking photographs or filming, but you can't protest. There's no political protest. You know, these aren't democratic spaces.
Uh-huh.
They're policed by security guards. Yeah. They've got CCTV everywhere. It creates a really different feel to the city. Now, I mean, skateboarding might seem a small thing, but I was in Barcelona the other week, and it was just so entirely different. There was no CCTV, and there were just all these people skateboarding around. I've never been particularly keen on skateboarding. I mean, I don't mind it, I can't even do it.
Yeah.
But it just created such a different feel to the city. It just felt like a free place.
Yeah.
And it just felt... I mean, Barcelona's also subject to its own issues around gentrification, but it's got a very engaged political culture, and it just felt like a city which was just, I can't put it any other way, just more free than this city here. And that's something that really strikes me about London in contrast to other European cities I go to, and I think that's really, really problematic.
I guess one of the sort of economic arguments that sort of builds on that as well is around agglomeration, and, you know, what are the benefits that we sort of see when we see people who can mix in different spaces and things like that. And arguably one of the sort of hotspots of gentrification being kind of the Old Street roundabout of London. Sorry to bring it back to London again, but those kind of areas where there's been a certain amount of serendipity as to, you know, why places have grown to be the sort of centre of these kind of industries. But there is something there, which is, you know, access to space does matter.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Interestingly, and we get your reflection on this, turn a little bit towards what we might do. You know, classically, you know, Jane Jacobs, much loved sort of dawn of cities, you know, she observed Greenwich Village and said this is a wonderful place and was concerned about change that she envisaged in Greenwich Village. Her response was, we need to preserve it as it is. We need to resist the change that is somewhat on the horizon. I don't know what you think about that.
I think you've elided two very different things there, actually.
Okay.
One is resisting certain types of change, trying to influence the change in certain directions over time, and the other is preserving it as it is.
Those
are different things.
Right.
You can never preserve anywhere exactly as it is.
Yeah.
Places do and must and should change. But it's perfectly reasonable to say that that doesn't mean that everything has to change according to a certain set of rules laid down elsewhere. It is perfectly reasonable to try and resist certain types of change or influence the direction of future change. And I think what she was talking about was actually trying to make sure that, that in those processes of change, you didn't lose all that was good about a place and the diversity of the different people that were able to live there.
Interesting. I'll come back on that and get your thought on how we might actually do that, which is the challenge.
It's about the housing. It's about the housing, because what you know, Ed was talking about agglomeration efficiencies, and that's about the job market. You can get real, you know, growth efficiencies from certain agglomeration of certain types of jobs. That's the current city's mantra.
Yeah.
All of those efficiencies are destroyed by a dysfunctional property market, which is extremely inefficient and sucks all of that additional value created by job agglomeration out and crystallises it into a dysfunctional property market.
Yeah, yeah. So would you be, you know, would that be about controlling then or trying to influence more directly you know, the nature of, I don't know, rent growth in certain areas?
It's about ensuring that there's a proper diversity of different types of housing for different income groups. And that means ensuring proper amounts of affordable housing are preserved and new amounts are supplied in the right places. So, you know, every part of every city needs to have a genuine mix of housing affordability ranges. Mm. It's not that, you know, everyone should be living in social housing and everyone, or that everyone should be aspiring to own, you know, £1 million flats by the Thames. You need a proper diversity, and any city that fails to provide a diverse range of housing, affordable, genuinely affordable to people in different locations on different incomes, will fail.
Mm. Okay, Anna.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has to be a recognition that if the most extreme effects of the housing market crisis, which I sort of see as interchangeable with gentrification, if that's going to be addressed, we need policy levers to do that.
Okay.
We can't do it without policy levers.
Yeah.
And when you look at other cities which have tried to address this problem, such as Berlin, which has been in the news quite a lot recently,
yeah,
they do it by intervening and saying, you know, we have to keep some spaces affordable for housing, for various business uses, and that's the only way that we're going to...
Interestingly, the way the Berlin rent regime works, they actually have to stop people from improving their properties in order, yeah, to keep the value,
yes,
down,
yeah,
which is a kind of almost a slightly perverse effect. Yeah. Why would you stop someone
well,
sorting out their bathroom?
I think that's surely problematic.
But that's just
well,
the nature of their particular rent regime. We don't, yeah, have that sort of rent control in this country. What we do have instead, actually, is still, despite decades of undermining it, we still do have a pretty resilient, affordable housing sector. And that's the main mechanism in this country by which you can ensure that cities do provide housing for a range of
people. Well, increasingly less so.
As I say, it's
I
being
mean,
undermined.
After the Housing and Planning Bill really started, as I'm sure you know, Toby, you know, after the impacts of that start to really filter through, things are going to ramp up, you know, far, far more than they are at the moment. But, I mean, none of this discussion is new.
No.
You know, 10, 15 years ago, the French were so worried about what was happening in London that they called it la Londonisation, and they looked at, you know, the processes of gentrification and how parts of the city were all becoming these sort of sterile, unaffordable enclaves.
Yeah.
And they had a set of planning policies specifically designed to stop them becoming like us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just seems to be abundantly clear that you can only stop these processes if you maintain some affordable space in,
yeah,
every district, neighbourhood, part of the city. And that involves intervention in the planning system.
I mean, I think what's interesting is when we do look at the German sort of model, you know, the rental model is so different over there, you know, with huge institutional landlords, much more the percentage of people renting.
Permanent security of tenure.
Exactly. And, you know, there's
limited
a lot of benefits,
inflation.
A lot of benefits to that, huge amounts of benefits, but a lot of those benefits accrue from a completely different system, and getting there is perhaps the more difficult part. I mean, there's also questions, as Toby brought up, you know, the Berlin example is amazing. I think it's mainly based off something to do with marble ceilings or something like that, something I heard. Anyway, and also I think there's a real issue there about actually trying to get into the rental market. You know, it does block people out of doing that. And, you know, you have to go through a lot of interviews because it's so hard to kick out a tenant once you've got one. It doesn't work so well because, you know, less people, you know, you have to go through a very sort of rigorous interview process. If you translate that to the UK, where we have a lot of, you know, landlords who have one or two properties, then you start to see a big disincentive to, like, bring more property into the rental market. I think that's just a sort of an issue that's not, it's not something that you can't deal with, but I think it is a genuine.
But I mean, like, you're looking at sort of supply side solution, I think, and the implication is that if there were more rental properties, prices would come down.
And yeah, I'm afraid those individual landlords don't supply new homes anyway. They just take homes out of the
unoccupied
stock.
It's probably going to up rents even more.
I'd argue that a lot of people would come out of the rental market,
and those homes would be sold to landlords who wanted to operate in a different market, or they would be sold to people who wanted to live in those homes. So I fundamentally don't see that that's a problem.
Right.
You know, there are arguments about incentives on supply, but our existing crop of landlords have no impact on supply because they don't really buy very many new build homes.
They're just building. It's the transactions within that you're primarily talking about and who's owning it. Yeah, quite. So we talked to say a little bit more about what sort of planning interventions we would need to be making if we were being serious about maintaining you know, the diversity of and the range of, or the mixed communities, income, etc., that you think we need?
Well, I mean, we're in a really difficult place because, in fact, we have just introduced a whole load of legislative changes through the Housing and Planning Bill, which are precisely the opposite of what we need.
None of which have yet come into force, by the way, so it's not over yet.
It's not over yet, but the direction of travel is quite clear. And while Sadiq Khan has commissioned a report, I think, on gentrification and is keen to look at these issues, he's not got any powers, I don't think, to intervene in the planning system in London to preserve affordable spaces to a significant degree, as far as I'm aware. Mm-hmm. So I don't see that there are any mechanisms open to him or other city mayors. I mean, I don't know if you sort of know more about the situation.
I would say that all of the emerging city deals are different, and the planning powers granted them, the combined authorities and the city regions, yes, and the mayors are varied. The London mayor actually has quite extensive planning powers, really does. It takes time for those to really flow through because new supply is always a relatively small proportion of the market. Yeah, we have an awful lot of homes already.
Exactly.
New supply can only ever be, you know, if we were building all the homes we needed, which we nowhere near are, it would be at best providing 10% of the homes each year that enter the market. So new supply is only one lever, but it is an important one, and planning is the key influence on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what I reject the idea, by the way, that this constitutes intervention. There's no such thing as a free market.
No, it's not
intervention. It's just which type of regulation and which.
Agreed.
But what I would say is that firstly, we need much stronger Section 106 policy, which is the rules under which developers and planning applicants are required to provide affordable housing, effectively as the price of the planning policy.
You know, I'm expecting most of the listeners of this podcast know that Section 106 has deteriorated into the total farce of financial viability assessments.
Absolutely. So we need to claw that
power
back.
We need to claw that back. But there's still choices. I mean, partly it's about the choices that we are, you know, whoever's in control of these make or don't make. To wield the regulation or to wield you know, the power that they've got. So just carry on for a second.
But it's also, and there's lots to be done on ensuring that we actually, that new supply has proper proportions of affordable housing. It's partly about Section 106 and planning policy. It's also about critically the use of land, including public land, which should be prioritised for affordable housing. It's also about the use of grant. All of these have been undermined in recent years, but they're not dead yet and they're still worth fighting for. But it's not just about new supply. These property market effects are mainly felt in the existing homes market, and sooner or later cities are going to have to wise up to the demand side pressures on house prices and how those feed through. Most of these gentrification effects, these polarisation effects, are nothing to do with new buildings at all. They're to do with the market and existing homes.
So this,
and
this,
that's where we need to really be directing policy thinking towards. You know, we didn't used to have house price booms and busts in this country. People act as though that's an eternal kind of inevitable feature of the market. It's not. It's a result of choices made in the 60s and 70s. Before then, we did not have house price booms and busts. And actually, there was much less economic difference and disparity between those who owned and those who didn't. It was much easier to get...
Isn't it very much connected to us getting rid of any sort of development land tax?
There were development tax changes, but critically, there was Schedule A tax was abolished. There used to be a tax on homeowners for the imputed rent that they were effectively benefiting from. Then we started subsidising home ownership through mortgage interest rates. We had a capital gains tax relief. There's a huge set of tax subsidies that encourage people quite rationally to overinvest in housing.
Yeah.
Inevitably, that pushes up the price. Then you've also got mortgage regulation. You know, the main reason why house prices didn't explode before the 1970s is because mortgage regulation was very tight.
Yeah.
As soon as you allow infinite amounts of global capital to flow into house prices,
what do you expect
to happen? Now, we have since the financial crisis, slightly constrained that growth, but only very, very slightly. So, you know, unfortunately, these are tough political nuts to crack, but we'll never really deal with these things unless we look at the demand side and address the problem of the existing homes market as well.
And many of those issues are fiscal, in orientation rather than necessarily land use or planning or, you know, housing questions and issues. Ed, you wanted to come in.
No, it's just a couple of things which, first of all, bring it back to that sort of mayoral, what the mayoral powers are. With that, I think it's quite interesting that Sadiq Khan's team is looking at the viability aspects at the moment and looking at, you know, how to fast-track that. I think it's something that's been looked at quite a few times in various different guises, but this time it's genuine priority for the mayor, so that'll be interesting to see where that gets to, especially combined with some of those planning powers that we've already mentioned. Mm. But I think also just that capital gains tax that Toby mentioned, it in a sort of that plethora of financial instruments which have sort of affected the housing market. I think that's that kind of element is massively important, just because when we look at how we invest and the decisions that we make about where we live and how that affects different parts of the country, you know, is massively affected by the land market. It's not, you know, housing costs are one thing, but it's also the fact that, you know, the potential gains influence our decisions massively. So, you know, keeping hold of property in London is always seen as sort of an attractive, something that's attractive to pretty much anyone around the country. I think that those are the kind of challenges that we see, which are sort of specific to the successful cities, really, especially in the south of England. And I think, you know, it's a slightly different kettle of fish when you look in cities sort of which aren't doing as well, and what the housing challenges are in those kind of areas are sort of completely different.
In many cities, I have heard people say to me, "We'd love to have
exactly.
The problem of gentrification would be one that we would ideally love to, you know, to be grappling with rather than worrying about wholesale decline of, you know, of, you know, large parts, if not all parts.
But the regional economic picture is one of hot cities and colder areas.
Yeah.
There are declining cities, and of course in those places, yes, again, what they need is a better diversity and a more resilient mix of people. And in some places that means, yeah, you need more higher earning people, you need more affluent jobs, you probably do need more artisanal bread. Where gentrification
the people
becomes
who would buy it, it's not really it's the capital coming into
yes,
the place.
Yes, sometimes there can be a kind of cargo cult aspect to gentrification where it is assumed that, you know, if you provide something, kind of some sort of Ponzi amenity, somehow a kind of economic transformation will occur.
Well, quite.
And loads of affluent people will arrive near. That is clearly not true. I think it is quite simple, though, really, is that all cities need to have a healthy, diverse mix of people of different incomes. And if you're straying away from that, then you know which direction policy needs to lead.
I think there's more of a consensus on that particular point, Toby, about, you know, if you look across at a, you know, at the city level, a diversity of opportunities, a diversity of offers, you know, related to income, etc., etc. But I often get the feeling that people actually, what they really mean is every neighbourhood almost has to have exactly that as well, and I'm a little bit more unsure of that definitely, but is that what you mean as well?
No, I think you've hit on a really important point here, which is that diversity and mixed communities in aggregate is undeniably a good thing, I would say, but that does not mean that, you know, it needs to be so fine grained that in every single street it is, you know,
there's a good mix of everything.
Every single house alternates between different income bands, and actually the health and diversity of cities does mean that you have different areas that have different characteristics, and unfortunately, I have to put this politely, bureaucratic systems can be quite good at taking sensible principles at a macro level and applying them far too rigidly
in the bid to create mixed communities, quite often destroying what are well-functioning, less diverse
absolutely. I can give you a perfect example of this. When the Olympic development was being completed, we had the unusual issue in London of 4,000 homes in the Athletes' Village going to be released at the same time. Now, normally that never happens. There was a genuine policy question as to what should be done with these. I argued at the time that actually there was an opportunity to allow kind of groups to acquire streets or clusters of homes or blocks together. The Charity Jewish community in Stamford Hill, for example, was desperate to find places that they could expand together because they need to live close together for Sabbath reasons.
Yes.
You know, there were other community groups. You know, I was part of a co-housing group that would love to have kind of moved together into one corner of a new development.
Yeah.
I don't know, for all I know, the kind of the biker community or the, you know, the bridge playing community or whatever may want to have.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just rejected, this was deemed to be absolutely anathema as an idea because that wasn't mixed communities.
Right.
And I would say this is applying a sensible principle far too assiduously at the housing level. Especially when you look at what actually happened to that development, which it was all sold for to one single private rented owner.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so many of these policy terms move very far away from where they originally started. Yeah. I mean, mixed communities was Aneurin Bevan's famous phrase of creating the tapestry of the mixed community where the doctor, the grocer and the butcher would live in the same street. And it was adopted much later as a way of mixing mono-tenure housing estates, which was arguably a good idea, but others saw it as a potential precursor to privatisation. And, you know, it has now seemed to have resulted in something very, very different happening, where a lot of those estates are going all together. So I think, you know, all of these terms, which become sort of shibboleths of policy, like mixed communities, affordable housing, gentrification, unfortunately, they travel very, very far away from where they originally started.
And I wonder, as we begin to close, you've all been very considered and even-handed in the way that you've thought about and talked about gentrification. And we did say at the start that, in a sense, it's a very an emotive term that generates a lot of reaction, positive and negative to it. And I wonder, your thoughts on how we can ground it again, and to recognise that in all of these things, there is a wide range of meaning, but more than that, there will always be good elements to these sorts of things and some bad elements to it. But a more considered and reasoned conversation is part of that, to identify, what we're really talking about and what we're not. But Toby, what's your, how do we reclaim the notion of gentrification and understand it in its entirety?
All right, well, to be less reasonable and bad.
Yes, it's not a criticism. You're
allowing the market in property to drive poor and middle income people out of areas.
Yeah.
Is economically insane, socially unjust, and deeply divisive. It's a massive, massive mistake. Encouraging that process deliberately with policy is positively criminal.
Right.
So if that's what we mean by gentrification, it's an unalloyed bad thing, and we should be resisting it wherever possible.
Yeah.
Having said that, change, of course, does happen. We just need to make sure that change works for everyone across the income spectrum.
Okay. Anna?
I don't think the term works for me anymore.
Okay.
It's become
Your post-gentrification.
Yeah, I mean, it's like affordable housing. When affordable housing is 80% of market rent or a starter home for £450,000, that is not, that's not the definition of the word. Gentrification is the same. So, to be honest, it makes for an interesting discussion. Mm. And a heated discussion, and as you say, it's an emotive topic. Yeah. But it's a term I prefer not to use.
Yeah. What would you? How would you talk about this subject now in that context without using those sorts of?
Well, I mean,
terms?
As we've said, I see it as an aspect of the housing crisis and the function of property capital and the property market.
Mm. Ed, how do we introduce some reason and some calm into?
I think my issue with a lot of talk around gentrification is when it's easily used as a way of sort of blaming people who move to a neighbourhood for ruining that neighbourhood and, creating a whole load of different services which aren't sort of useful for anybody and freezing out the property prices. I think it's much more useful to look at a whole city rather than just neighbourhoods within this. I think, places, cities change, but neighbourhoods change within cities. And I think I'm much more ambivalent as to the role of specific neighbourhoods within a city, as long as a whole city caters for a whole sort of range of people. Because I think that's actually the way cities grow, that's the way cities adapt, and that's the way our cities are going to thrive, is by accepting change in different neighbourhoods for the sort of greater good of the city. I think the sort of the positive thing that I can see is going back a little bit to what we mentioned before, is around city management. If we can get a much more kind of strategic look across a city where we can, allow for, different communities to thrive in different areas and, have lots of different housing types in lots of different areas, then we can start to sort of ally some of the fears around gentrification and sort of start to see some of its benefits instead.
Very good. My guests today have been Anna Minton, Toby Lloyd and Ed Clark. Thanks for being part of City Talks. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities.
Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre4Cities or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. City Talks is edited by Ilya Popovsky. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.